Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Runner's World Podcast.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Runner's World Podcast. Each month we'll be bringing you interviews and news from the wide world of running. Kerry, what have we got coming up on this month's episode?
We've got tons this month, but I think among the highlights we have an interview with Sophie Raworth, BBC newsreader, who's just run across the desert. We have an interview with another nutty runner, Rob Pope, who has tracked the route that Forrest Gump took in the film Across America, and we also have an interview with Runner's World columnist Paul Tonkinson.
So what have you been up to, Kerry, this month?
I have been mostly running in a massive storm in Boston. I achieved a lifetime ambition of running the Boston Marathon, which is the oldest marathon in the world. It was the 122nd running of it this year. I was massively excited to be doing it, got there. The day before, it was beautiful sunshine. The day after, it was beautiful sunshine. The day of the race, it was -8. There was a storm coming off the Atlantic, and there was a headwind for all 26 miles of it.
And how many layers were you wearing for this?
I was wearing 4 layers on my legs, 6 layers on my torso, and 5 layers on my head, one of which was a plastic shower cap from my hotel.
Classic race day wear. Well, I had the opposite, actually. I was pacing at the London Marathon, which I think was the hottest London Marathon record.
I believe.
So it was something like 24 degrees, and there was a lot of carnage out on course. It was very, very hot. Lots of people fainting and the rest of it, but managed to get the flag round just.
Yeah, no, I went and watched it. I was trying to work out afterwards which is worse, running in extreme kind of cold or heat, and I don't think there's an answer to that. But when I was watching London, there were people, like you say, there were people getting dragged off the course like sort of dead buffalo. It's like, oh, is another one gone? Let's get rid of them.
Yeah, it was early on as well. It was in the first 10K, people were really struggling with it. But I think of the 200 people that started with my flag, only about maybe 5 got round in the right time. So that's great pacing.
You were one,
yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah. I was one, yeah. So aside from your marathon running, Kay, what else have you been doing?
What did you mean? I can't just run majors for the rest of my life.
Surely there must be more to your existence.
I'm trying to improve my swimming. I think a lot of runners will have the same problem, that when they, you know, they train for a spring marathon and then summer is looming and it's difficult to kind of maintain your focus. You might have an autumn race in mind, but I think I'm going to take the opportunity this year to train for my first triathlon, which means improving my pathetic swimming and work a bit on my speed as well. Do some, you know, short, sharp race in the summer. I don't know about everyone else, but I really don't want to be doing slogging marathon training throughout the summer.
Yeah. No.
What about you?
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit about some speed stuff, which I think would be a nice idea. The idea that as a team, perhaps, we could attempt the 4-minute mile. So the idea.
Yeah.
So maybe everyone does a lap, you know, 4 laps of a 400-metre track, or even 200 metres, you know, a couple of times between 4 of us.
I think the operative word there is attempt.
Yes, I think we still wouldn't do it. But it's a lot trickier than people think. But I'd be interested if any rapid readers want to give that a go as well, see how close they get to the sub-4. But I think it really is a great achievement, even with 4 people, actually.
Maybe we should set something up on the site, or you know, with Strava or someone like that, where invite teams of 4 to give it a go.
Yeah.
Have a leaderboard or something.
Yeah, it's not easy.
We'd have to
easy.
Do a bit of training ourselves first, because we don't want to set up a leaderboard and then come bottom of it. So,
were we thinking of going to that rather random track in Regent's Park that isn't actually 400 metres?
Yeah, no, it's 380 metres, but if you run, I think I've got this right, if you run on the line between lanes 2 and 3, you're actually running 400 metres, but it's kind of stretched out and oval, like, longer than a normal track as well, which
right.
means when you go around the bends either end, it's really tight cornering.
Right. the kind of 180.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, what could possibly go wrong or right, in fact? But yeah, so something like that in the summer. I agree with you. I think summer lends itself to speed and maybe some kind of slightly sillier challenges like the beer mile or something.
Yeah, that would be good. I mean, I remember talking about this last autumn, having done the beer mile previously and you know, acquitted myself reasonably well.
Yeah.
Trying to do a winter version of it, you know, like the mulled wine mile.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
But then this spawned all sorts of conversation in the office about what would be the best booze to have if you're running a mile. You know, stronger ones would probably hit you quicker, but they don't have, like, the gas problems that you do with beer.
Sure.
But I'm all for, you know, trial and error and experimentation.
Absolutely. Well, it's self-sacrifice, isn't it, at the top of the sport?
Yeah, well, you know, when you work for Runner's World, you have to take these things seriously and put the man hours in, I feel.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So there's been some sad news this month as well. The late, great Bruce Tuller passed away, who was a sort of pioneer of barefoot running and also a previous coaching editor at Runner's World. And Kerry, you had a chance to meet him, didn't you?
I did. I met him years ago, not long after I'd started at Runner's World, I think 2009, and I went out to a training camp in Portugal where he was one of the coaches.
Right.
And he was awesome. He just had that kind of aura about him of, I've been there, done it, but in a really kind of polite, humble sort of a way. And he would just sit by the side of the track and give people little tips and pointers quietly if they chose to receive them. He wasn't kind of foisting himself on anyone.
Yeah.
And I'd never really heard of him before, but I went and looked him up, and, you know, he's definitely one of our greatest athletes and definitely one of our most unsung athletes, I think. But, you know, he competed at the Rome Olympics, which I think was 1960. He was European 5,000 metre champion, which he achieved by running barefoot, like you say. He set a new record in the late 60s for running solo across America, which was, where have my notes gone? 2,876 miles in 65 days. That's quite something. Almost as good as clocking a 2:47 London Marathon at the age of 58. He's written books, he's set up marathons. I think he set up a marathon in Kenya where you run across a game reserve.
Yeah, it's Faricom,
that's the one. So they have to have rangers with rifles at certain points to kind of keep the lions away and helicopters overhead and stuff. So it sounds nuts, but, you know, that's the kind of way he thought. It kind of like, anything can be achieved, let's go for it.
Yeah, I think absolutely incredible person. Actually, this interview that was in Runner's World in, when was it, actually? It was maybe,
I think we last interviewed him in 2015.
And yeah, it's really interesting, his sort of philosophy on running. So was quite low mileage. You know, he achieved lots of his record-breaking stuff on 30 to 40 miles a week. Lots of those miles running barefoot as well. And he says that he very, very rarely gets injured. And part of the reason for that was, he attributes it to the fact he was almost race weight the whole time. So for Bruce, that was very light. It was kind of between 8 and 9 stone. And also he believed that actually, you know, doing a lot of training on grass or sand in his bare feet stopped him getting injured.
So. Yeah. I mean, I remember on this training, we went out for dinner to a restaurant one night where we managed to escape the camp. And, you know, even at the age of, he must have been mid-70s or something then, he was still incredibly disciplined about what he brought his wife out with him, and she was, you know, just eating normally like everyone else was. And Bruce would just kind of like, he'd order a normal plate of pasta but not finish it all. He would think carefully about whether he was going to have a dessert or not. But it was all completely second nature. It's just, you know, maybe it's because I'm such a glutton that I notice things like that. But it's just really admirable. I mean, you know, I think once a runner, always a runner.
Yeah, for sure.
And indeed, once an elite, always an elite. He had that mindset. And I think that's probably why he stayed so healthy and so involved in running right to the end.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? What's happened to kind of, where the kind of barefoot boom, didn't we, of Born to Run, which again was something that Bruce met the Tarahumara Indians, I think back in 1971, apparently. So decades before McDougal went down there and kind of discovered
That tribe. I think McDougal's book was 2009, wasn't it, or something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. So he's a real pioneer on that front. And I think his approach to barefoot running is a really smart one, in that he wasn't saying, I go barefoot running on concrete and I do 70 or 80 miles. It was like, I'm a light, skilled runner and I throw barefoot running into my training. And I actually think more people could potentially look at that, because I think barefoot running has become a little bit of a dirty word. And maybe it doesn't need to be.
It has. I think, you know, everybody got very excited when barefoot running came out, and then people started wearing fancy shoes that, you know, that made certain claims that weren't necessarily backed up by the reality. A lot of people got injured. There wasn't enough credible information about the subject.
Yeah.
Apart from, of course, in the between the pages of Runner's World. But, yeah, people think that you're kind of an evangelist or a bit of a nutter or just odd if you do it. But it's definitely just like interval training, hill training, training on sand dunes. You know, there's a place for it as long as you do it sensibly and appropriately.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's exactly what Bruce's legacy, one of the things that Bruce's legacy should be all about. And, yeah, we're trying to honour Bruce, actually, this Friday 18th of May, and we're doing a Barefoot for Bruce 5K in Hyde Park. So we're starting at 1 p.m. at the gate closest to Hyde Park tube station. So anyone who wants to come along and honour Bruce's life and legacy, you can see us there.
So in the studio with us, we've got Paul Tonkinson. Good afternoon.
Hello, mate.
Paul is our Runner's World columnist, one of our two columnists in the magazine. He's also, I was going to say keen runner, but that's doing him a disservice. He's an awesome runner.
Yeah.
A sub-3 marathoner.
Feels like ancient history now.
Yeah, but once you've got the time,
once
it's done forever.
Once it's there, yeah.
And, yeah, all-round running enthusiast, does his own podcast, stand-up comedian. Good afternoon.
It's way too early for legend, isn't it? I mean, I've got another. Well, if I maintain some kind of tempo and creativity, 15 years, almost yeah. Legend.
Almost legendary.
Almost legendary.
Well, we'll see how you do in this podcast. Yeah. Now we can give you a verdict at the end. Yeah.
Steady. At the moment, I'm a hardy perennial.
Well, on the kind of legendary sub-3 status that we've decided you've got, I mean, you did the sub-3 last year.
Yes.
And that was what?
A massive effort.
A massive effort.
Yeah. Yeah, it was surprisingly difficult and took so much focus. I think I'd taken it for granted up to when I was running in sort of like early 30s or whatever. I thought it's just going to arise naturally, and then I kind of realised that it wasn't. I was going to have to focus everything on it. And by the time I did it, so I was 47 years old. I was virtually a full-time athlete for about 6 weeks. I hardly gigged, you know, sort of sleeping during the day and, you know, sort of doing the Paula Radcliffe. So I wasn't doing cold baths, but I was sort of. I took it way too seriously. But having said that, it was great to get. But my goodness, I don't know whether I could do it again.
Yeah. I mean, what's your running been like after that? Has it been quite hard to get back on the...
It's been sporadically intense. I floated into the summer. And then the great thing about a spring marathon is that you've got so much base fitness, haven't you? With a few speed sessions, you can quickly... You know, crack a few PBs. So I ran a little bit on the track, 5Ks and 10Ks, and was good. And since October, it's been a tale of sort of slight injury woes, really, and not as much training as I'd like. I keep sort of pinging my back. I've pinged my back a couple of times. It's been a couple of weeks out, and it's just getting back to that sort of running naturally. The summer's brought me out again, and we were talking just before the podcast started. I'm hoping to do my first track session of the summer, really, tonight, if all goes well. And I'm desperate to run, like, club championships and short races. I was going to pace London. I wasn't fit enough for London. Looking at the weather, I think I made the right choice. I think it would have been quite calamitous. And, yeah, I'm just... To be fair, I know it's not a particularly inspirational message. I'm nowhere near fit at the moment.
So does that mean... So for those... For regular readers who have followed your column and those of us that run as well, work at Runners World, we know that... you've got people at your running club who you use as a benchmark. There are people that you normally try to beat or who can beat you.
Yes.
How is that going to work tonight when you're not fit? Are you going to be hard on yourself?
It's going to be pretty poor. Well, I was chatting to Rick. I was saying that's a tough thing when you come back to racing. It's a real blow to the ego because the people who are used to trounce in the long reps or even just tailing the long reps, you've lost it. I was approaching the back end of the A group towards the end of last summer, which was it was a dizzy height. I was getting dizzy, and now I'd be definitely off the tail end of the B group. You know, but my ego won't accept just joining the C. What I should do is just join the C group.
No.
Longer recoveries, less work, but I won't do that. I'll plunge in tonight, probably end up injured again, and then the process will continue. You know, it's unless you quickly lose fitness, you can get it back, but you quickly lose it, don't you?
Yeah, it's a pretty unequal ratio, isn't it?
It can be.
The amount of time you have to put into to just grabbing little bits of fitness and then you just lose huge chunks like that.
Especially as you age. you start to, it takes a long time to get it back. And also weight as well. I think for me, weight's quite crucial. Just the, obviously, the thinner I am, the faster I get and feel. I'm a, sort of about half a stone overweight, and you just really feel it.
Yeah. But you must be pleased with achieving sub three, because I remember when you first started writing for us and you said, look, I read the magazine, I used to run in my youth, I've just sort of got back into it.
Yeah.
And then over the last 4 or 5 years, it's been a steady progression. Then one day you were like, sod it, I'm going to do sub three.
It was so torture, wasn't it? I was aware that I brought so many people into my psychodrama, the yearly assault. So yeah, don't get me wrong, I was very pleased to do it. And it meant a lot to me, and I gave a lot to it. And it was a period of life which I really enjoyed. I really like it when you're running, when you've got an event that you're really giving everything to, because it just simplifies everything else in your life. You've got a structure, you don't overeat, you don't overdrink, you look after yourself, because it's all about the event. And I'm not very good at that, but when I do focus, I really go for it and I really love it. And so for that to come off was just a lovely sensation. That intensity, I think that's what running can give you, is it can give you a sense of shape and control to your life, as life can get quite chaotic as you get older, or life just gets more chaotic generally. And races give people that simplicity, and I really value it.
So would you say that you're quite an obsessive personality then? Once you set your mind to something,
I can be, yeah. Once I'm in, I'm all in. And that was a great thing about beating three. It's an absolute state, isn't it? It's like, you've either done it or you haven't. So I've got club mates and they've like done 3 hours and 40 odd seconds, you know. And we were chatting before, like, well, it's sort of three, but it's obviously not though, is it? Do you know what I mean? Time exists. It's an absolute state. And once you've done it, you've done it. And it undeniably felt, it felt amazing. Yeah, it really did.
I think there's two ways this stuff can go. So when you, and it doesn't have to be sub three, it can be sub four. I think the numbers.
Of course, yeah, absolutely. But, of course, yeah. It's just your aim. It's your goal.
Exactly. And I think once you achieve a really hard goal like that, you can either say, I'll never do that again. I'm really, really glad I did that. I did it once.
Yes.
Which sounds a little bit like your approach. And certainly Andy, one of our editors, done sub three once, and he's really happy with it, and that's fine. Or you get someone like Kate Carter over at the Guardian running blog.
Yes,
who did 2:59 very recently.
Yeah,
and is already thinking about
getting faster,
sub 2:55. And it's I think you can kind of diverge when you achieve
I mean, she sort of the difference is that she's relatively a better runner, isn't she? In terms of like the percentage of women running, she's way faster than I'm in terms of the percentage of men running. She's closer to an elite woman than I am to an elite man.
Yeah.
I'm sort of like a decent-ish club runner sort of for my age. And she's obviously a very good athlete. So I totally get what you mean. At the moment, for me, it's a little bit too early to say. I just want to get into gradually running more regularly and sort of just little injury niggles, try and have a quick track season. And then I might recommit to try to go for 2:55 or something. But I don't quite know. Because as you get older, it gets harder.
Yeah.
So you've got to train harder as you get older to run just a little bit faster. I don't know whether my wife will accept it.
There seems to be a growing trend among runners who decide that they're not going to get any faster or whatever their distance is, to go, right, well, the one thing I can do is go longer.
Yes.
So can we see you expecting to strap on a backpack and be running across various countries?
I think I'd love to do that. I see the... once you've accepted that you can't go faster, I still hope that I might be able to go faster at shorter distances, because I did loads of running when I was a kid on the track, and so I always loved track running, like 5Ks on the track or, you know, 15, even 1,500 metres. I really love that. So I want to get a bit of that in. And then I see that the last, it might be the last stage or the second to last stage, sort of adventure races. So I put ultras in with adventures, or like, you know, let's run this marathon in a strange and exotic place sort of thing. Just running purely for a laugh, which I will definitely do, but I'm not there yet because I'm still competitive. And I still want to beat my mates.
It's the equivalent of becoming an international football manager, isn't it?
Sort of, just floating around, just floating around, except no one's paying you.
Yeah, the sort of Sven role.
Yeah, just guest appearances, you know. So I look forward to that,
So I guess most people know you for your comedy, really. I mean, is running a great complement to the work you do?
I think so, because it kind of, it keeps you... as you do stand-up comedy for a long time, people tend to fall away because they the lifestyle tends to be unhealthy. I mean, the hours are unhealthy. There's a lot of driving late at night, and it can be you can eat rubbish. Obviously, there's loads of drink, and there's loads of other supplements early on in careers that tend to truncate natural life. So a lot of people get very unhealthy quickly, and just don't last. They just don't last the pace of it. I'm hoping to do stand-up comedy for probably the rest of my waking years. You know, I really love doing it, and to do that I'm going to have to be fit, and running really helps that. It also helps mentally, because it's like running's many things to you, isn't it? It's a therapist, it's a mate, it's a laugh, it can really drive you hard sometimes, and it can be your best mate, you know. So I just really need it and value it, and it can also be very creative. I mean, I don't run around with a pen and paper, but I understand people who do. You know, you can work out problems, you can have creative breakthroughs, especially because a lot of my running when I'm not in the track is really long, slow sort of forest stuff. I mean, I just love that's where I'm happiest, running slow through the woods, really.
Yeah.
So when you go on tour, then I presume your trainer's one of the first things that you pack, and you're looking at running routes. And
absolutely, I go out, and I mean I do a lot of stuff around the world with old McIntyre. So we do like arenas around the world, and I'm always running like Norway through the mountains, or in Melbourne they've got that little.
Sounds awful, isn't it?
I know it's really really
that's
bad.
Tough life.
Really bad. I went for a run through Central Park recently because we're in New York or Melbourne. There's that little run around the park. I've forgotten what it's called now, but it's a timed run around the park, which is really nice. It's a way of exploring as well, isn't it? When you go around the world. I mean, you go around the world. It's amazing. Yeah. Is it very, very lucky to do it? Just strap on and go for a run, not know where you're going to go. And just come back 45 minutes later, just refreshed and with more of an insight into where you are, which is good for your gig as well. You get a feel of the place, and you feel fit.
And so, what do your? You just said that it's generally quite an unhealthy industry, or can be. So, what do your fellow comics make of it, McIntyre or whoever else? Do they think you're bonkers?
But I think that. I mean, Michael rarely exercises. he jogs around the stage. So I think he probably does a few miles every gig. He's very fluid on stage. A lot of them realise that they have to do something. There's a lot of couch to 5Kers out there. There's a lot of people starting to get into running. There sort of tends to be two schools. There's the kind of completely nihilistic, let's just eat whatever we want and still you know, party. I use that term loosely, for as long as possible. And then there's a more fit and healthy ones. It tends to be a bit of a divide. And the younger comics are all really fit and healthy.
So it's a generational thing.
There is a generational thing. I mean, I came through sort of in the 90s, sort of the boom years, and it was like being in some sort of film or something. It was like it was so debauched. And you'd go and do a gig in Watford and it would be like Vegas or something. I mean, everyone would be partying like
24-hour party people.
Everyone would be going absolutely mad. It's like, we're in Watford. We haven't made it. We're just doing a gig in Watford.
This is my Vegas.
So, and it was like that. But we've, the people around then who are around now tend to be the healthy ones.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So I've been reading your columns, I'm sure lots of people listening have, and one of the ones that I thought was particularly amusing was essentially runners who annoy me.
That was...
A couple of months ago.
Yeah, it wasn't so long ago, that one, wasn't it? Yes. And I realised when I started writing it that there was going to be loads more, that I was only scratching the surface of the phenomena, really.
Let's talk about a few of the ones that you talked about. The first up is the breathers. And this isn't just people who breathe. You do say this in your column. It's people who breathe in this kind of... slightly overdramatic way.
No! It's those types, isn't it? I mean, we all like to breathe. And they're all going to... You're going to breathe, how are you going to breathe? But it's just... It's the torturous breathing of it, isn't it?
Do you think they're putting it on a bit?
To be honest, I don't know. It feels like they're being chased. It feels like they're extras in some horror film. Are they just showing us that they're... You know, is there a showing-off element, maybe, that they're trying harder than the rest of us? I don't know. I mean... I really don't know. I just know that it always inspires me to run faster so I'm not within earshot. And they do tend to be the ones who finish going, yes! Yes! Clutching their fists and looking at their garments. Yeah.
Another one of the ones you put that really resonated with me, actually, was the runners who loudly thanked the marshals. So thank you, Marshall.
That was generous spirits of you, Paul.
I'll tell you what, this came up. This was actually... Rob Deering, you know, we do the podcast Running Commentary, and we record it while we're running, and Rob's a keen runner, and you know, it's just really nice, relaxing. That was actually his observation of, like, obviously it's great to thank the Martians.
Yes.
They're amazing, and without volunteers we won't be there. But I think it's because when you're running next to someone saying that, they've got the energy to do it, and you haven't. I kind of do a sort of pathetic wave and a grunt. I mean, thank you, Marshall. Thank you for your time, Marshall. They just seem to have too much energy. But having said that, I am actually marshalling my first race on Sunday.
Oh, well, maybe you'll change
your mind.
I'm
doing the Crouch End 10K, so I'm going to insist on a thank you, Marshall, from everyone.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Will you be thanking your Marshall?
Rick, I feel at this point we should have one from you on what gets your goats.
Well, actually, yeah. It's a little bit similar to, and I'd say they're the coasters. So these are people, normally men,
right,
who have obviously conserved an unheroic amount of energy,
right,
for the final 100 metres of
right.
the race.
Yeah.
And their sprint finish is not just a great sprint finish. It'd be a great, like, it's probably their 100 metre sprint finish.
Yes.
And you feel what are you doing back there? Like,
spread
your effort a little more evenly over the race. And then if you can muster a genuine sprint finish, I'll be the first to applaud you. But don't do it.
No, you're right. No, you're right. This, again, I think what we tend to be talking about here is any kind of showboating, any kind of playing to the gallery. I mean, we all know running races is hard, and we all like a good, honest effort. And if you're doing a good, honest effort, you shouldn't have anything left at the end. You shouldn't really be making too much noise, and you shouldn't be able to thank the marshal. I mean, you know, you should be absolutely stretched with all your focus on being as quickly as possible. But, you know.
Maybe we're kind of stymied a little by our nationality. The thought strikes that if we were American, we probably wouldn't be having this conversation.
No,
we'd probably be whooping and hollering our way to the finish.
And while thanking the marshal. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Maybe it is, yeah. Maybe we're just not fit enough. That's the lesson.
Well, I think your third one is, I think you're absolutely right about this, runners who try to overtake me in the shoot.
Yeah, I mean, that's just, to be honest, I think a lot of that is sort of inexperience, isn't it? And them not realising that the race is over. Like, it comes down to, again, how tired you are if you've run the race right. If you've run the race right, you can't accelerate down the chute. It's all over, isn't it? You run to the line. But some people don't know. But my goodness, I tell them. I'll spread my arms out. I'm not going to let them pass. I will not let them pass.
I remember it was one of, it was a cross-country race I did, the Surrey League, and I was really, really trying, and I got to the chute, and I actually threw up around the just over the chute. And
Thank you, Marshall.
A teammate of mine, who I'd finished ahead of, overtook me in the chute and was
That's outrageous.
Me.
That's outrageous.
I never forgave him.
Yeah, that's outrageous. So, I'll tell you what, cross-country's hard, though, isn't it? I started doing it. I did it loads as a kid, and then I just had a return to it a couple of years ago and started doing it ever since. It's so tough, isn't it? You've got to be so fit to do cross country well.
Yeah,
I really like it. It's amazing to be fit for cross country. It's incredible, isn't it?
I feel there's a kind of a limit on the swankiness of the kit you can wear there as well. You have to kind of look a bit old school, grungy, bit muddy. You can't be like all the gear, no idea, rocking up for a 7 kilometre.
No. There's no. Well, there's people in Heathside who just don't respect you if you wear any kind of gloves or sort of hat, no matter what. He's got to be almost. I mean, when I started, when I was a kid, it was almost you didn't wear sockless, spikes, short shorts, and a vest. But there's zero respect for decompression socks and gloves in my club for cross country. It's a bit retro, really.
It's similar to fell running, I guess. It's that same kind of less is more, back to basics mentality, I think. Yeah. Mm.
I'd like to do fell running again. That's really tough, isn't it? Going down, isn't it? Going up, you can kind of stay with a fell runner, but going down, different story.
Yeah, different set of skills. Yeah.
They're just kind of kamikaze, aren't they? Just hurtle downhill.
Yes. Yeah. They're courageous.
So I think one of the things that some of our readers wanted to know with regards to your columns was how you go about writing them, where you get your inspiration from. And the one thing that I wanted to know is how much does Andy Dixon edit them?
Occasionally there'll be the odd clumsy edit. Most of the time it's fine. In terms of inspiration, I tend to get it just while I'm out running and just making notes. And also, when I chat to comics, I say I do a column about running. They say, "Oh, what can you do about running?" In fact, there's so much you can do and say, and running bleeds into everyday life. There's so many aspects, isn't it? It becomes so part of you. It's just more about your life, really, isn't it? Because if you're always running, then it's always part of your life. So I get it from everywhere. And the length has wildly fluctuated, actually. He started off about 650 words, and then he said he can do more. So now I'm a bit more. Now I've just thrown in anything over 800 and let him do what he's going to just let him do what he's going to do with it. Yeah, but mostly the edit's fine. Yeah, we'll let that go. Let's thank you, Marshall. Thank you, editor.
I mean, maybe you should always file with thank you, Marshall.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's become a meme.
Are there any sort of races on your bucket list, Paul, that you like would absolutely love to do that you haven't done?
It sounds a bit of a cliche, doesn't it? But I'm quite fascinated by the Marathon du Sable. I'd like to do that. I know ultra runners are like, oh, it's a bit kind of cliche to do the Marathon du Sable. But I've chatted to a few people who've done it. It just seems quite a nice experience. I like the sort of way that you are kind of, you're not on your phone and it's just really basic and it's just, there's something about it that I chat to Susie Chan a lot, who's obviously, she's done it four or five times and she's a massive fan of it. So that one I'd like to do. I'd like to do New York. I'm not that motivated by medals, to be honest. I'm not one of those people who just desperate for medals. I'd like to do New York. And that's it, really, and just fast and just cross countries and nationals and just basic. But as I get older, I will want to do more. I'd like to do Jerusalem Marathon just because I'd like to go to Jerusalem. It gets more location based then.
Sure. Yeah.
I just don't think I'm ever going to be fit enough to do like the big American ultras. I just don't think, you know, like Susie's trying to do she's running a 100-mile race this weekend coming, and if she does well in it, the prize is to run another 100-mile race.
Hey.
Badwater. In another really hot race on tarmac for 100 miles. That's just a different mentality to me. I have to accept that. If I do ultras, it will be trail ultras. It will be through the country. But, yeah, those are the big two. Marathon du Sable and New York for me.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the running commentary and the kind of the premise of that?
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, the running commentary, the podcast, it arose very naturally. Rob Deering is a comedian and runner who used to run more than me, actually. He kind of dragged me back into running. And we started meeting every now and again to go for a run through the woods and just talking, and realised that a lot of runners will realise this. The longer you run, the better the chats tend to get to a certain stage, you know, to about an hour and a half. And after that, you get a bit tired and things kind of dry up a little bit because you're too fatigued. But there's a kind of golden spot post 40 minutes for about 25 minutes where things feel looser, you're more lucid and funnier and honest and philosophical or whatever. And I really enjoyed it. And I just said, why don't we just record this and do a podcast? So we did. And it's called Running Commentary, and it's for runners, by runners, recorded whilst running, which is its unique selling point, I suppose. And we get guests in, we get runners, we get journalists, we get the odd politician, authors who like running. And it tends to work. It's very low-key but good fun. We go running, things happen on the run. It's very little editing involved. They run anything from 45 minutes to 2 hours.
Yeah.
they're really not bite-sized chunks. We keep meeting with the people who, you know, like Acast, and they say, could you not do like, you know, 25 minutes and, with, you know, each one 25? And we just don't, we're not interested in that. We do long ones. And we get really devoted fans who start listening and then just go back and start listening from the beginning. So, because we've done one a week now for like over 2 years. Yeah. And it's a very enjoyable thing for me.
I think it's really interesting. I'm interested to know what you think, Kerry, on this, but the idea that you have good conversations by running, I think part of it is that you're not looking directly at the person you're talking to, because it's less intense.
Yes, yeah.
Same as when you're in cars, actually. You have a good conversation in cars for the same reason.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Bit like therapy, isn't it? Some therapists, with modes of therapy, you face away from your therapist, don't you, famously?
Right,
face away from them. I've never thought of that. That's a nice idea. And it's the endorphins as well, isn't it? And it's just,
it is, yeah, definitely. I think the act of movement as well.
Yeah.
So before I was a journalist, I used to work in a variety of sales jobs.
Right.
And, you know, even from a rookie, you're taught that if you had an important call to make or one that was intimidating, you should stand up.
Interesting.
And you should walk back and forth at your desk, because that would give you more confidence. It would give you more creativity.
Yes.
And I think there's something with that, with the running as well, where, like you said,
you're more lucid,
you're more free-form, yeah. Just everything's firing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I always remember as a kid just going for runs with clubmates and just running for miles and just the chats. I've always really associated running with talking if I'm with someone else.
Me too.
And I really like it. People say, how can you run and talk? It's because they're more sort of a headphone listening to music orientated. But for me, it's either just on my own in silence or with friends talking. I find it very pleasurable.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah. Paul, thanks so much for coming on the podcast. Absolutely great to chat to you about running, and we look forward to the next column.
Awesome.
Thank you, Marshall.
Thank you, Marshall.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So one of the letters that came into my inbox was from a guy called Simon Flowers, and he wrote in, and I'll read it out. It was, I have come relatively late to running, only starting when I was 60, and I'm now 65. I've been reading, subscribing to Runner's World for most of that time. I find the majority of the articles in your magazine very informative, just the majority, and I'm basing my marathon training program on one of yours. However, I have noticed that many of the training articles say to include technique maybe two or three times a week. For example, the strong arm tactics in the June edition. If I was to do all the recommended exercises, I'd be spending all my time training. But I, and I'm sure the majority of your readers, have other pulls on their time and cannot train as much as all the articles would result in. So could you perhaps publish an article that identifies a training plan that takes no more than, say, 1 hour a day, and that should include running time? I think it's a really interesting question, that, isn't it? Because, yes, people are time poor and they want to do strength and conditioning, but they don't want it to take over their life. Do you think we can come good on Simon's question for one thing?
Firstly, Simon, I would like to know what the hell you're doing with your time, frankly. When we're not writing at Runner's World, we are doing every single thing that we put in the magazine.
Absolutely.
I mean, we have no time to sleep, but, you know, we get it done. No, it's a fair point. And actually, it did make us think. So I did a bit of research, and I talked to Tom Craggs, a running coach who works with Running With Us. And he put me onto something very interesting called Oregon circuits, which is exactly the kind of thing that I think that Simon wants. It's circuit training for runners who are time poor. And they're so named because they were named after the University of Oregon, where they were invented or first used in 1983. So I asked Tom to explain why they're so good, and he said this. He said, this is the perfect HIIT session for runners. It improves speed, strength, cardio, stamina, posture, and all over fitness, and there's no equipment involved.
It sounds incredible. What is it?
Now that sounds like a good deal, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So for those of you who are interested in taking advantage of this, grab a pen and a paper. It's not that complicated, don't worry, but you do need to make a couple of notes. And Oregon circuits, they can take different forms, but this is Tom Craggs's prescription. So rotate through the following movements continuously for 8 minutes to make one set. And those movements are, you need to be near a track or a treadmill. Firstly, run 400 metres at 5k pace, which is kind of 9 out of 10 effort. Then do bodyweight squats times 20, the plank for 20 seconds, 20 alternate lunges, so that's 10 each leg. Do a bridge for 20 seconds, and then a static squat where you're just squatting down and not moving for 20 seconds. So rotate through those continuously for 8 minutes. That's one set. Do 3 sets with 2 minute rests in between. After a few weeks, Tom says, if you're starting to find it easier, which hopefully you will, build up to then to 10 and then 12 minute segments as you progress.
Right.
So that's pretty good, isn't it?
That's pretty good. Yeah. No equipment. Very easy to do. Very quick. And with a bit of pedigree because it's from, you know, a fantastic running background, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you know, you can do all of those things apart from the 400 metres in your flat. And actually, it strikes me that if it was peeing with rain outside and you couldn't really get down, you could just furiously run on the spot for 90 seconds
or skip
or anything that gets your heart rate up massively.
Yeah.
That could substitute in for the first rep, and the rest of it, you don't need anything at all. Do it while you're watching Emmerdale.
I think it's really good. I think body weight stuff is, you can do almost everything body weight. The only thing I would say is, and this is personal experience, and I'm not Tom Craggs, a celebrated coach, but I think that a couple of kettlebell exercises thrown in, so the kettlebell swing, which I think is very good for hips and kind of glutes, and maybe a weighted squat just to give that kind of, that real challenge to your glutes and your quads might make that circuit even more challenging if you became
bigger. Yeah, I think it would. But, you know, also I think this is where we kind of, we start getting mission creep, don't we? Because,
there's
this awesome thing and this awesome thing. And, you know, there are so many great moves that runners could and probably should do. Mm. But as a kind of lowest common denominator, this is probably as good a routine as I've found for people who say, I don't have any time and I don't have any money and I don't know what I'm doing. Well,
here you go.
There you go.
Well, we will include it in the show notes at the end so people can give it a go and let us know what you think. If you have got other questions similar to Simon's, you can email podcast@runnersworld.co.uk. We'd absolutely love to hear from you and what the kind of stuff that you would like to hear more about on the podcast.
So I got a letter, actually, recently, which I thought was probably worth bringing up. From a runner who was concerned with quite a good issue, actually, which is kit for plus-size runners. And he said, flicking through a recent issue of Runner's World, I immediately skipped ahead to the gear reviews. Lots of it looks great, so I immediately tried to order some of it. Unfortunately, the brands featured suffer from the same issue as a lot of other retailers. There just isn't any gear for sale for plus-size runners. I'm an accomplished 10 to 15K runner, currently training for my first half marathon, but as I have a dreadful diet, I'm still wearing a 3XL or 4XL top. I understand that for most runners, that keeping active will mean they are healthier and slimmer, and that suppliers have to cater to the majority, but not everyone is. This is even more obvious at organised events where generally the free race t-shirts and the goodie bags are never big enough. Could RW run something about this? Name and address supplied. Yeah. So, yeah, I think that's a really good point. I did look into this. There is some good news. Unfortunately, I can't come to you guys and go, well, we've discovered, you know, loads of brands that will cater for you. When I spoke to, I'm not going to name any names on here, but, you know, the usual brands that you would expect and that you associate with the running world, you won't be surprised to hear that the issue with this for them is cost.
Right, yeah.
It's a simple matter of supply and demand. They don't feel that it's worth their while producing size runs for bigger runners when there are relatively few of them. Yeah. But a little digging around reveals that there are a few brands who runners can go to. We spoke to Julie Crefield, who's kind of a real kind of advocate of running for plus size people and being bigger, not necessarily deterring you from being active. She's the founder of a website called toofattorun.co.uk. She sells a range of T-shirts and vests and hoodies, all technical. But even she says, you know, she struggles to find plus-size suppliers. T-shirts only go up to size 22. She says you have to order in large quantities to make it financially viable and then usually only sell one or two in those sizes. Mm. And this is an interesting point. Also, plus-size runners tend to be self-conscious and therefore quite particular about what they want. So it's a difficult market.
Yeah, I can see that for sure.
I think if anybody is looking for where to get started, Nike has a new plus-size range for women, which goes from sizes 22 to 30. I think prices start at just under 25 quid for a crew neck T-shirt. There's a women-only brand that just makes leggings, which we featured in the magazine a couple of times. I think they're really cool. They're called Lucy Lockett Loves, which is an odd name. But they go up to size 28. They just make leggings. They're, you know, kind of really blingy, bright, flamingos, palm trees, that kind of thing. But they're all technical fabrics. 16 quid for starters for a vest. For chaps, there's a brand called Bad Rhino that stocks sportswear in sizes from large to 8XL. Starts at 7 quid for a vest. So that's pretty handy on the wallet as well. And a brand called North 56 Degree 4. Which also goes up to 8XL. It's a little bit more expensive. It's 40 quid for a tech T-shirt, but it is higher spec stuff.
Is it reasonable to expect races to supply a wider variety of sizes? Maybe it is.
I think, well, when it comes to race organising, what we've seen, I think certainly you and I, having been...
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Doing this job for a while is that the larger events have the infrastructure to be able to take specific orders from runners in advance. So if you think about, for example, the London Marathon, when you fill out your application, they'll say, what T-shirt size are you?
Yeah.
If you're doing a smaller race where a lot of the entry fee is going to go back into producing the event for next year or maybe it's going to charity, they obviously have to take a middle ground as to what the most popular size is. That it's really unfortunate because how many times have you received a race T-shirt, we're like, that doesn't fit me, and it sits in a drawer forever, or you give it to a charity shop. But you can understand why it happens. I think until a technical brand comes along that supplies the race industry and provides very, very cheap T-shirts where they can afford to buy in all sizes, I don't think with regards to race day T-shirts that's going to change unless we have a whole system whereby you order yours afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's reasonable as well, isn't it? But I think if there are a few brands that actually do specialise in this stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I sympathise, I really do, because if you've trained for a race and you want to wear the T-shirt proudly and it doesn't fit, that's really irritating. You know, almost as bad as getting a dodgy medal when you want, a really heavy bit of bling in your hand. But so hopefully those brands are of some help. Thank you to the reader for kind of writing in. It is something we've meant to do something on. And if anyone out there knows of any other brands that they want to recommend, do let us know.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
Back in 2016, Rob Pope just felt like running. Since then, he's crossed the US four times, following the route plotted by Forrest Gump. In doing so, he's clocked up more than 15,000 miles and raised thousands of pounds for a variety of charities. When he's not running across continents, Rob can be found breaking records, most recently at the London Marathon, where he broke the record for the fastest male marathoner in a film character costume, running a blistering 2:36. I caught up with Rob to find out what motivates someone to embark upon such an epic challenge. So what I want to ask to start off with, Rob, I think, is why? I mean, what motivated you to take on the kind of Forrest Gump run of America?
Is this when I deliver the I just felt like running line?
Only if you want to.
Yeah, man. Like, to be honest, I've done it about 1,000 times now and I still can't do the accent, so I think I'm going to save people the upset of it. But I wanted to run across America for like ages, and when I say ages, I mean so 10 years plus, and had read like books on the subject. But this run sort of came about just because of the desire to do something like pretty special for charity. You know, sort of my mum, who's not around anymore, was probably the person who got me into running. She said, do one thing in your life that makes a difference, and this was it, I thought, and so I run in for two amazing charities, which are the World Wildlife Fund and Peace Direct, and they stand for the five things that Forrest was asked was he running for in the film, which are women's rights, world peace, the homeless, the environment and animals. And of course, that's when he gave the line, but I've at least got a few causes.
I mean, there must have been so many highlights during the crossings. Are there any that sort of stick in your memory more than others?
Finishing the crossings, each of the individual ones was like special in its own way. Like Santa Monica, surrounded by friends. The second one was the first I completed on my own, and I had like one close buddy with me, and that was like sort of really atmospheric in the fog, and it was just like super cool. And the third crossing I ended up like sort of running back and competing in the Oregon State Championships the next day for the 10K, which I won. How's about that?
Amazing, yeah.
And then the fourth one, I was just on my own at sunset. The day before, I was due to fly back home, and I thought I'd never actually complete that crossing sort of before I needed to go back home. just because of injuries and weather and everything like that. And then, of course, the final crossing was unbelievable just because not only did I get to the famous place in Monument Valley, but I also got to propose to my girlfriend, Nadine, as well. And she said yes. That could have been a low light if she'd have said no. but places-wise, you know, sort of everything through the desert, like Joshua Tree, Death Valley, you know, obviously home of Badwater. So I ran a good chunk of that course through up to, like, the Glacier National Park in Montana, which is, like, sort of semi-tragic at the same time because it's super beautiful. But the glaciers of which from which it takes its name, they reckon aren't going to be there beyond 2030, which lends even more importance to, you know, me trying to help the World Wildlife Fund out as much as I can to see if we can do something.
Yeah, I mean, from a logistics point of view, I mean, were you carrying all your own stuff? Were you camping out? Were you staying with friendly strangers? How did it work?
Yeah, it was 50-50. I started off, like, so my girlfriend was out with me and we sort of bought a cheap camper on the sort of the hope that we'll be able to sell it at the end and not be quite as broke as we are because we self-funded probably about 85% of it. It's still not sold, by the way. If anybody wants a nice Ford Fleetwood Jamboree, we can send you the details.
We'll put the link at the end of the podcast, Rob, don't we?
Yeah, great stuff. And when we got to, like, the middle of Tennessee on the second crossing, we were just pretty much running on fumes. And I said to Nadine, I said, there's no way we're going to get to Maine if we carry on like this. And so that's when she had to go home. And I just carried on with Pram Solo, my trusty baby stroller, named after sort of the man himself.
Yeah.
Because I look a little bit like Chewbacca, so.
Well, you have grown yourself a mighty kind of Forrest Gump-esque beard for the crossing, haven't you?
Yeah, exactly. I shaved on September the 14th, which is the day of 2016, the day before I set off, and I've just not touched it since. Like, occasionally the moustache needs trimming, and I think it needs one at the moment, to be honest. But, yeah, I've still got the beard and stuff because I feel like I'm almost still on duty with the run because the charity job isn't complete yet, and I think people like the beard as much as they run it, even if it's not, you know... even if it's not sort of actually on the road anymore, which makes me sad.
Well, you also found time to come and run the London Marathon this year and break the record for the fastest, male film character?
That's the one, yeah. I think it's just fastest film character full stop.
Just a 2:36 for you, which isn't bad. That's not bad at all.
Yeah, it was a really big surprise because the way I ran in America, it was just such a, you know, a gentle, you know, it was all about injury avoidance. You know, I probably ran quickly about three or four times, Oregon, Boston Marathon, but that was like, sort of not as quick as the London one, especially because I had a beer halfway around. And then,
well, you ran 2:36 having a beer halfway around?
Oh, no, that was a Boston I had a beer.
Say, right.
Yeah, I did 2:58 at Boston, but my plan originally there was to just basically bimble round in whatever time, high-five the kids, you know, sort of, and just enjoy the brilliant Boston crowds. And I got to about mile 16 and thought, God, I feel all right here. And I thought, I had my phone because I've been taking photos, and I got my calculator out, and I was just like, what time do I need to do to get under 3 hours? And so I'd been doing about 7:30s. And I was like, right, okay, 6:08. So I did 1 mile like that, and it felt okay. Did the second like that, and I thought, I'm going to give this a go. And I was doing 5:40s by the end, I think. So somebody pointed out that sort of if I'd have carried on doing my, you know, increasing my splits at that pace, if I'd have done a normal 40-mile day, I would have broke the world mile record. So, you know.
Well, I was going to ask, I mean, what's next, Rob, for you? Like, when you come back from doing, like, an amazing challenge like that, is there a kind of, do you get kind of post, it wasn't a race, but a kind of post-race blues? Do you feel like, what can fill that space?
I haven't really had the chance, you know, because I came back sort of, you know, when I did London Marathon, the reason why I came back was because my baby daughter was being born. So I'm, like, doing as much of that as I can, but, you know, sort of when we got back, you know, literally broke. And so, yeah. I landed on the Monday and I started work on the Tuesday. So, yeah, it's just still taking stock. But you know, I haven't run. This tonight's going to be the first run since I've got back, which is awful. But, you know, I've entered Berlin in September, and right. So I'm going to try and see if I can go pretty quick in that, and then follow that on with a cheeky marathon day starb next April as well.
Oh, yeah, nice little kind of walk in the desert. Sounds good. Well, you mentioned your day job there, because it's interesting. I mean, you're a kind of qualified vet, Rob, aren't you?
Yeah, and so I use my skills a slight degree on the run, because we managed to actually find a stray dog when we were in Arkansas, and she was in a pretty bad way, but still, you know, still wagging. But between ourselves and the local community, we managed to rehome her, and now she lives pretty much by the start of the Boston Marathon up in Massachusetts. So that was sweet.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. Using your skills on the road, yeah.
Yeah, exactly, and sort of, and you know, we almost caught scabies off her because she was she was pretty fruity, you know. Sort of, yeah, that was just a real nice moment. That could actually still be my highlight, the whole thing, you know, something that I do day to day, and I go across America, and it's still my highlight.
Yeah, that's pretty good. That, I mean, I was going to ask you. I mean, with the Forrest Gump run, everyone knows Forrest Gump, you know, loved running and the rest of it, but the actual details of the trip are, I mean, how much research did you have to do, and how much was actually did you have to kind of imagine when it came to retracing his footsteps?
Yeah, it was mostly stealing other people's bits of research, right. Really. Like, I knew about the rough route for years, and there's a figure of 15,248. A number of ones have been mentioned. I think BuzzFeed said 13,900. Another article said 19,000. And so I looked into that 19,000 figure, and it's just far too big, you know, because he doesn't do five crossings of the states. It's only 4 3/4.
Right.
And my longest crossing, which was a very circuitous route, was 4,000. So I sort of figured, well, if I go for the middle figure, and I completed that, like, probably about 300 miles before the end. So I had, like, a little private finish for myself, because I knew that the actual finish itself was going to be madness. And it was, like, sort of those news crews, like, yeah. So many of the local population turned out to see us. Like, sort of one of the head guys at Garmin was just jogging down the road, and he asked me in his French accent, "What is going on?" And I just said, "This is happening." And he was just like, "Oh, my name's Tilly, my wife, and I'm coming running with you." So, yeah, we had about, like, sort of 30, 40 people running at the end, and, you know, double that watching. It was great. It was real sort of film moment. But yeah, like, obviously I needed to get the various outfits in place, so I've watched that scene about 100 times. And then sort of just little bits, like finding some niche locations to do it. Like, the first time I ran to I ran to Grandfather Mountain, which is where the famous Forrest Gump curve is. And when I got there, they'd had a dump of snow the night before, and so they closed the mountain.
Right.
But I wasn't going to let it beat me. At the end of the run, I flew to Atlanta, drove 6 hours to that to where I'd, like, sort of, you know, had to pause, and I was just like, I'm getting up this mountain, and I did. So very good.
I wonder how you feel when you see the film. Do you feel like you've kind of been kind of communing with Forrest for the last few years?
Yeah, I tried to channel my inner Forrest on the run. I think that's the reason why sort of everybody's, like, sort of, you know, bought into the run so well.
Yeah.
Because he's, you know, he's just the ultimate nice guy. He doesn't judge anyone, like, whether it's background, race, whatever, you know. So he just sort of, you know, he just treats people nicely, and in the meantime does some incredible things. So even when I've felt pretty lousy, I've always tried to run with a smile on my face, and, you know, people have responded to that, I feel.
Yeah, it sounds like you were treated very, very well in the States. I mean, were you surprised by kind of how hospitable people were about your challenge?
I wasn't necessarily surprised, because everybody sort of, you know, there's obviously the hospitality culture there, you know, there's the phrase, isn't the Southern hospitality?
Yeah.
But I was actually wondering how much of it was going to be real and how much it was going to be the fake have a nice day stuff.
Mm.
But, you know, like, sort of, people just wanted to help you. They're very sort of personable, and, you know, sort of, they want to see, like, you know, what you're doing, like, and if there's anything they can do, you know. Even if they had no interest in the run, I'd be running down the road and someone would pull up and go, hey, buddy, do you need a ride? And I'd be like, oh, thank you, mate, but I'm, you know, sort of not allowed.
Yeah.
I reckon if I'd have taken those rides up, I probably could have been done in about 3 months the amount of time that it happened. But, like, people took me into the houses, you know, fed me, bought me beers, you know, sort of, you know, people, you know, gave me, like, sort of, you know, they'd shake my hand and there'd be cash in the handshake. And
wow.
People like, oh, thanks very much. Yeah, a lady, like, sort of a really poor area in Arizona, like, sort of, you know, one of the, inverted commas, trailer camp places. First of all, she offers me an umbrella in the rain and I was just like, oh, I'm okay, actually, I can't really carry it. She comes back 20 minutes pretty much with the contents of a penny jar for me. And yeah, it's just real little things like that.
If people want to find out more about the Challenge Robin and help you raise money for the charities, where can they go? Is it the website or?
Yeah, like there's a Virgin money giving link on the website. It's just a big button saying donate, and there's even a little crude exchange rate if you want to donate from Australia or Europe or America. And so, like, my target on those 50,000, but, like, deep down, I'm secretly going to be sad if I don't raise 100. I just figure it's, like, the biggest, pretty much, it's the biggest fast run of its type, I think, sort of, apart since Girard. And so, yeah, I reckon we can do 100K there.
And remind us what the website is, Rob.
It's goingthedistancerun.com.
Okay, great. Well, look, congratulations, Rob, again on such an incredible challenge, and whatever you do next, we'll look at it with interest. Thanks very much.
Well, the big thing is, you know, sort of in Forrest Gump, you know, sort of Jenny shows him a picture of the Runner's World front cover,
yeah,
and it's Forrest running that. So come on, guys, you've got to give me that cover shot.
We'll see what we can do. We'll see what we can do.
Brilliant.
Right, cheers. Thanks a lot, Rob.
I'll put it for a good photo. Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
Bye.
Bye.
For more from Runner's World, head to runnersworld.co.uk.
So this Saturday is the night of the 10,000 metre PBs. For those of you yet to hear about this event, it started in 2013 by Highgate Harriers Ben Poche to get people excited once more about the 10,000 metre distance and about track running in general. It takes place at Parliament Hill Athletics Track, and this year will be run in conjunction with the European 10,000 metres Cup. One of the many things that makes the event so exciting is that the crowd are literally on the track cheering on from lane three. We're both huge fans about this, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, beer and running, what's not to like?
Mm.
As long as you don't get them in the wrong order or get the wrong people doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody wants Joe Peavy, you know, swigging a beer in lane three while I'm waddling around on the inside.
That could be maybe next year.
That could
year.
Be a winner, yeah.
Next year, yeah.
I think at a time when everyone in track and field up to Seb Coe has been saying that athletics needs to be made more attractive to the masses, it needs to be brought out of its slightly kind of more traditional niche, and people needing to be reconnected more with the sport. I think, you know, this is only a very small corner of that, only a small starter, if you like, but I think it's definitely a fantastic example of the way to go.
Yeah, and, you know, last year there were 7,500 fans. So yeah, there's a real appetite for this. You know, it's kind of, and it's growing all the time. 2018 on Saturday will be, I'm sure, more popular, and next year more popular still. It's
Yeah, I mean, I think we should probably actually clarify for the listeners that it is a serious race.
Mm. Oh,
there
yeah.
are the nation's top 10,000 metre runners taking part and competing against each other. In the past, it's been used as a qualification event for World Championships and Olympics. The difference is, as Rick said earlier, you know, instead of being up in the stands, kind of like waving foam fingers and stuff, you could touch the runners if you wanted to. You are that close to them on the track, and it really adds something to. So the atmosphere, both for you and for the runners, who I think are really galvanised by it.
Oh, I think so, yeah.
It's very
yeah.
popular from their point of view.
Yeah, I think you get lots and lots of PB, so it comes good on the title of it. And I mean, it's a little bit like, you get it in the Tour de France, don't you? You know, people on the
yeah.
course, you know, and some of those people aren't behaving as well as they might. But I think that kind of excitement, we just don't see it in track running, do we? So I think it's a really good move, and it'd be interesting to see if it spawns other similar events, I mean.
Yeah, I think probably there will be. I mean, I'm not aware of any others around the world, but I'm sure there are one or two. But if it can gain enough traction and just get race organisers, even up to, you know, even at, I think, at the level of the Diamond League, where they start thinking about how they're presenting their products, and at the end of the day, it is a product,
yeah.
to the masses, it could be really big. If you look at other sports, obviously cricket developed 2020. Mm.
another athletics initiative was they had the Nitro Games in Melbourne, didn't they, last year,
exactly.
which I think was an IAAF initiative. And they had, I might be wrong about this, but I think the idea was they had athletes competing in events that weren't theirs.
Yeah.
So like Usain Bolt throwing a javelin and stuff like that, as well as their own thing. And each athlete would do a few events. And it's just, it's obviously more lighthearted. It's not about fortune and medals and stuff, but it enables the athletes to show another side of themselves and the crowd to be engaged and everyone to just have a bit of fun. And I think if you're trying to attract a younger generation, this is the way to go. And I can imagine if you took your kids along to Parliament Hill to watch this, it's a bit like fathers would talk in the old days about being taken to their first football match by their dad, and they remember the smells, the sounds, the atmosphere. And, you know, who knows what that could spawn in future in terms of future champions.
Yeah, actually. Exactly. And I think, you know, running up close like that, it is dramatic. There is theatre in there. I mean, there's people really trying. It could be a great race. Hopefully, you know, the lead could change around a little bit. I think actually there's this view of track running as being quite, not bloodless, but being quite clinical. And I think something like this is shows the kind of human and the kind of excitement of these events.
Well, yeah, of course. I mean, when you're that close, you can hear the wheezing, you can see the kind of the strain in their eyes.
Exactly.
You start. Yeah. You don't have to be a running aficionado to spot things like, you know, their gait starts to go, they start rolling around a little bit, any tripping that's going on, which you can't normally see when you're up in the stands. It, you know, it's quite exciting.
Yeah, I think so. I think there's also, I think it's Strava who've put on a special mile event, which involves slower runners being chased down by a chaser. So you go off with a slight head start, and then the chaser comes, and the idea is the chaser, as soon as he touches you, you're out.
So it's just like a big game of tag, basically.
Like a huge game of tag, yeah.
So that's a great
it's
idea.
It's quite fun, isn't it? Again, it's in a way of kind of reinvigorating, like, track running.
Yeah, so, especially if the chaser dresses as some kind of Scooby-Doo villain with, like, a sheet over them or something.
We'll call Strava up and see what we can do, so we can arrange.
This is the Runner's World podcast.
So this month on the podcast, we have an interview with BBC newsreader Sophie Raworth, who some of you may know is a very keen runner. That wasn't always the case. She's been running for about 10 years. She's worked her way up through the distances and last month fulfilled an ambition of doing something very crazy, which was running the Marathon des Sables across the Sahara. So we caught up with her to find out what went on there.
Now you've had a few weeks to let everything percolate. How does it? What are your thoughts on it? Can you believe you did it?
It was the most extraordinary experience I've ever been through. I think the complete terror beforehand. So it was such a big build-up because I signed up to it 18 months ago, and then every time you have to pay deposits and you have to pay a bit more, and every deadline I paid on the very last minute I could pay, and every time I thought, am I really going to do this? And maybe I'll pull out. And then about a week before I went, I was so frightened about going, and I just, it was the complete fear of the unknown and could I do it, and I haven't got a good history of running in heat, and was I going to collapse, and was it going to be a disaster, and I've got three children, and what am I doing, and was I going to die? it was complete, I got very extreme, and I didn't really say it to anyone except to one of my makeup ladies at work about 4 days before I left. And I just said, I was going hot and cold, and I said, I think maybe I should pull out. And they were all looking at me like, really? And I kind of said that to my husband in a roundabout way about 2 days before I left. I wanted him to basically say, this is not a responsible thing to do. You are a mother with three children. What are you thinking?
Yeah.
Why are you doing this? And when I kind of, in a roundabout way, sort of tried to get him to say that, he looked at me and he went, you've done all the training. Of course you're going. And then I went, I promise this is my last big adventure like this. And he looked at me and he went, what are you talking about? Don't be ridiculous. So it was really, it didn't let me off the hook at all.
So, but if he had said, look, darling, please don't go, would you honestly have pulled out?
No, of course I wouldn't. I couldn't. couldn't. I would have been letting too many people down because I'd signed up to do it with a friend from work, and then Susie Chan, who I run with all the time, she had then said she was coming and her husband was coming, and then another friend of ours called Tim Jones was coming, and a couple of others. There were seven of us going, and there was at the last minute there was no way I could pull out, but it was just that, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway. And even when we arrived there, we flew into Wazazat, and I sat next to Susie on the coach. I think she realised because she sort of left her husband and came and sat next to me. And I was having this complete sort of meltdown. What was I doing? Where was I going? And you have a six-hour journey into the desert.
Yeah.
And then you arrive at the camp. And actually, once I got to camp, and I knew where I was okay. You just have to take it day by day. But it was the most extraordinary experience. It was far more than I ever thought it was going to be. It was, it was really tough. It is tough.
Okay, so from the outside, there'll be lots of readers of Runner's World who know all about the MDS, and they've read about it in our magazine or other magazines, and they think, I could do that. What is it that makes it so different once you're actually there?
I think it's a lot of it's the camp life, actually. That's what I wasn't expecting. And the camp life is as important as the running. And also, I think in terms of the running, the scenery is something I just never thought it would be. I kind of just thought flat desert. But it was just so varied and so beautiful, and you know, Jebels, the mountains, and yeah. And these great salt plains and dried riverbeds, and it was spectacular. Some of it, I can see why these film directors go there. Some of it looked like Mars. It just was spectacular to look at. It was hot. I don't think it was as hot as it has been in past years. Oh, a couple of days were really hot, but we had like one day when it was actually quite cold. It was hot. That was tough. The terrain really took me by surprise, because I know this sounds ridiculous, but Susie had said to me, it's not that sandy. I mean, a lot of it's quite hard and you're running on rocky ground, which is true. But day one we went out and it was just non-stop sand dunes, which is very difficult to run in. And obviously, living in London, I haven't got great experience of running in sand dunes.
No, I would imagine some of the sand in Hyde Park plus a few hill reps up Primrose Hill is about your limits, isn't it?
That's, you basically hit the nail on the head. That's exactly what I'd done. A bit of sand in Hyde Park. so that was a bit of a surprise. And, you know, day one was really tough and hard on our legs, and you kind of thought, my God, we've got days and days more of this. But it's the camp life as well, which is extraordinary, because you know you get up every morning, you go, you leave at 8:30, and you go off. We were out there for between 4 and 6 hours most days, apart from the long stage. And you get back in the early afternoon, and they give you your water and your brown plastic bags, which are very fundamental.
Mm-hmm.
You go back to your tent, and you just literally lie down, and you don't move. And it got to the point, you're so tired, you're physically exhausted, but it got to the point where there was a black bin liner on one of the poles of our tent, which was about 2 feet from where I was lying, and Susie and I actually ended up having a sub bin, because we couldn't make the effort to get to the bin, so we had to have a little bin right next to us so that we didn't have to get up to go to the dustbin.
So there were no games of cards or spy or anything.
You have to carry cards. You can't. That's grams. That's grams carry. You can't. You know, anything.
That's true.
Anything you take with you. Before I left, Susie came over here, and she's obviously done it three times before.
Sure.
And she and I sat up in one of my study up in my house, and we were literally weighing my shorts, my spare pair of shorts. Was it too heavy at 40, whatever they were, 50 grams? Was that going to be too heavy? You know, it becomes obsessive about the grams that you're carrying.
So kind of like sawing your toothbrush in half to get, and all
yep,
that kind of stuff.
Yeah, had all that. Sawed my toothbrush in half. I mean, you carried the minimum. I had my luxury item was a blow-up pillow, which Susie thought was excessive, and I took a pair of flip-flops, which she didn't complain about too much, but that, as it turned out, I was the only one who had flip-flops. Everybody else used my flip-flops. I could see why they didn't complain.
Oh, yes. I bet they thought, well, we'll just use Sophie's. We'll use her
exactly.
as the back wheel to get them round, and we'll take advantage.
But it was, you know, we'd come back from your run, and you'd just lie, you'd clear the stones, and you'd lie down on the tent floor. There were eight of us in the tent, and you'd just, sleep, or you'd, try and repack your bum, pack your bag, I tried to wash my running kit out, or rinse it out, because I didn't have a shower for 9 days. You are filthy dirty.
Yeah.
So you try and rinse your kit out and hang it up. You do all that. And then you just lie there. And actually, we just lay there and we laughed. There was so much banter and laughter. You don't really leave your tent. I had visions of going to the MDS, and I speak French, and I love it's a French race. And I thought, I can speak lots of French. It'll be great. I didn't leave my tent. I spoke to the seven other people in my tent for a week, and that was it. It was incredible.
Fantastic. And so, going on from that now, what's next? Are you going to go up into the mountains for an alternative, or is that you done with ultras? Or
I'm going to race some horses. I'm off to do man v horse.
Okay.
That'll be quite funny. That's in June.
Yeah.
So I'm racing. I don't even know what I'm doing. I have no idea anything about it. I've been told I'm racing horses. So I'm still running and training and everything. So I can run. It's 22 miles in the Brecon or near the Brecon Beacons or in the Brecon. I don't even know where it is.
Yes.
I think there are 50 horses under the. I think they set them off and. 15 minutes after us, and we have to try and keep ahead of them. And it's you'd think that they could beat you, but they get pulled off the course every once in a while because they need to be checked over. And also, I think they find it hard going downhill or something. So I'll see how many horses I can beat. And then I haven't really got anything. I mean, I'm doing the Great North Run, and I'm going to do London Marathon again next year. And I haven't actually got anything lined up. I'm sure I will have, but
the opportunities will present themselves.
Hopefully.
So you've said in the past that Brendan Foster got you into running originally. I think 2011 or something like that. Has there ever been a point, particularly in the MDS, where you thought, bloody hell, Brendan, I hate you. What have you got me into here?
No, I loved it. That was Brendan was 2006 was the year after my second child, and they asked me to go and run the Great North Run, and I did it really just to, lose some baby weight. It was a challenge. I thought, I wonder if I can do this. And my husband at the time was running as well, and he plays a lot of squash. He can't run anymore, but he was running. So we both went and did it together. And I loved it, actually. I really enjoyed it. But I could never, ever imagine turning around and doing it again and doing a marathon. And it took me quite a long time. It took me for another sort of 5-6 years before I actually plucked up the courage to do a full marathon.
Now. You must think, God, that's nothing.
And I know we're at half marathon now. It's like it's great. It's a sort of nice distance to run because I do that on my train. I ran 10 miles on Sunday. It's a sort of training run now. I've never ever, not for one minute, have I ever regretted taking up running. I love it. It's
yeah.
Complete. It's such a release, and it makes me really happy in a really basic way. It just you get all the endorphins, obviously.
Yeah.
And I love that it's the one sport, for me anyway, that, you know, the older I get, the faster I get. I got a part run PB 2 weeks ago. I couldn't believe it. And I was thinking, you know, what other sport could you do that?
That's very true. So does that mean you're going to try and get faster at the shorter distances, or are you just kind of going to go?
You know me quite well, Kerry, don't you?
Yes, a little bit.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm going to try and do now. I'm going to keep, I'm running. I've lost quite a lot of weight, actually, in the desert. I left quite a lot behind. You just cannot carry the food that you need to replace the calories.
Yeah.
So I've come back lighter and faster. I don't know if the two are, equate, or whether it is entirely that, or whether it's just a sort of confidence thing. But I've definitely come back.
They definitely equate,
don't they? I know. So I've come back quite a lot faster than I was when I left before I left. So I'm enjoying that. I've had two parkrun PBs in 2 weeks. I might go and try and do another one.
Wow.
It's sort of. I'm going to concentrate on a bit of speed, I think, now, and see if
summer
I can
of
keep
speed.
Doing that.
Keep holding your fitness. So, have your kids been inspired by you, or do they think you're bonkers?
They think I'm bonkers. They definitely think I'm bonkers. They call me crazy mum all the time. But they, two of them, all three children are really sporty, and my two younger ones, my 12-year-old is running in the England nationals, schools nationals today, running 1500 meters. So she's whacking out a 5.5 minute 1500 meters at the age of 12. So she's doing all right. And my son, who's 10, runs. I had a very bad parenting moment last weekend because I did my part run PB and I beat his PB by 1 second. And it was that moment when you think, do you say anything or do you not?
So what did you do?
I said something. I told him. I had to buy him an ice cream afterwards. But he was very funny about it, actually, because I said, it's great, don't worry, because we will go and run part run together. I'm only a second faster
than
you.
That's fantastic parenting, as far as I'm concerned.
I know.
Because A is something for you to do together, and B is teaching him that, you know, life is tough.
Life is tough. Your mother is going to be.
Yeah.
No, he was very funny, though. I said, it's great, we can run it together. And he looked at me, raised his eyebrows, gave me the most sarcastic look, and went, run it together? Yeah. As in, I'm going to absolutely thrash you next time. So, I'm clinging on to my part run PB for my 1 second for as long as I can.
So let's envisage you're running together at parkrun, you're coming up to the finish line, you're neck and neck, you can see he's straining to beat you. As a mother, what do you do?
If we're neck and neck, I'll let him go. If we're neck and neck, I'll let him go. No, I would let him go. He's only 10. That's a bit brutal. If we're neck and neck, I'll let him go. If he's moaning about it a mile from the finish and I'm going really fast, I might let him. I might
put the afterburners on.
Exactly. He's so competitive, though. He'll keep up. He'll definitely. He's fast. He's good.
Cool. And just finally, you're quite vocal on social media about your love of medals.
Oh, my love, yes.
So what's your favourite one that you've received? And which one would you love to get in the future?
Oh, that is a good question. My favourite one... My favourite one? Do you know? I don't know. I'm thinking the ones that are going through my head are my London Marathon ones. I love my London Marathon ones every year.
Mm-hmm.
My six-star finisher one, that was the combination of that and the Chicago medal. I love the clanging, because when you can always hear the people who've done the world majors, when you get your six-star medal, so you get your medal for the marathon, so mine was Chicago.
Yeah.
And then you get the other one on top. And then walking around, they clang together. And you can just tell the people who've finally done their six world majors. So that's very special, that one. And I also really liked my London Classics medal, which is the one where they, the London Marathon people have this new medal, which is if you do the London Marathon, ride 100 and swim Serpentine. You have to do 2 miles around swim Serpentine. I'm not a swimmer at all, and that is how much I love a medal. I'm actually made myself swim in open water for 2 miles. I was really slow just to get this medal. But it's huge. It's a really good medal. So I'm quite proud of that one too. Yeah.
Good. And in future, if you could wave a magic wand and have the athletic ability to do any event in the world, what's top of your bucket list?
Any athletic event in the world. I don't know. I can be really fast as well with my magic wand. Just to go and do anything? I'd love to do an amazing track race and do a sort of Mo Farah, 5K around the on track would be incredible. That sort of sense. I love watching them, and the speed is incredible, and just the sort of exhilaration to be able to run at that kind of pace. But in terms of big races, I actually, at the moment, really just enjoy going out into the countryside and the trails and the just kind of discovering new places. I mean, I can see the UTMB is in my head, but I'm not sure I can. I'm not sure I can cope with the UTMB, and it's sort of 2 nights of no sleep, and you get to the finish and there is no medal. That is really slightly playing with my mind there. You get a gilet. Not a medal. So
that's true. However, recently I know the comedian Rob Deering sent you a homemade medal because you lent him a pair of socks for the London Marathon.
It's on my medal rack.
You could have your husband and kids there with a specially commissioned UTMB medal for you.
I know, but it's not the same if it's not from them, is it? And if you make your own medal, that's a bit sad. I don't know. I've got it on pause. My big races is a bit on pause at the moment. I need my family need a bit of time to get over the whole MDS thing,
So park run for now.
Park run, Great North Run. I'm gonna go for it, the Great North Run. Go for it. I'm gonna try and do one more London Marathon PB next year. I'm gonna see if I've got that in me.
Oh, what's that? So you've got your PB's 3:28 at the moment, isn't it?
3:29. So I quite like to go see if I can go faster. I'd like to go sort of Susie and I want to go sort of 3:20. Well, she wants to go sub 3:20. I'd quite like to go. I don't think I can do that. I don't know. My Garmin says I can. My Garmin reckons I can do a 3:15 marathon. My Garmin is a bit deluded, but I think I could probably do 3:23. I don't
know. That's very precise.
I'm getting
good at calibrating your own level of ability.
Exactly. So I'll see if that's possible or not. But I'm just going to keep enjoying it. I love it. Really, really kind of, it's really important in my life now.
So that brings us to the end of this month's episode of the Runner's World podcast. I want to say a big thanks to our guests, Sophie, Rob and Paul, and to Scramble Studios in Soho, where this was recorded.
Yeah, and if you want to get any more from Runner's World, head to the website, runnersworld.co.uk. And if you want to get hold of us, you can tweet or Instagram us on @runnersworlduk, or you can email us your thoughts on podcast@runnersworld.co.uk.
Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next month.
The Runner's World podcast was recorded at Scramble Studios, Soho.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.